Chapter 11, Race and Society. I had become convinced. Science spoke eloquently and pervasively. Race is real. It is flesh and blood, brain and hormones. It is in every cell, in our DNA, and in every particle of our being. It creates poverty or wealth, crime or community, superstition or science, ignorance or education, tyranny or freedom. It composes the melodies of Mozart or the obscenities of a rap song. It creates glittering cities of promise or disease-ridden slums. It slashes and burns the Amazon or plants a million trees. It gives birth to Aphrodites or crack babies. It carries mankind to the moon or casts him into hell. It not only colors our skin, it colors the world. It expresses itself in millions of ways, overt and subtle, hateful and sublime, raw and refined. And it rules us whether or not we want to acknowledge its power. It is like the tide. It will have its way. No matter how government might try with social welfare programs, education, or affirmative action, races cannot be legislated away or made equal to one another. No matter how the media tries to deny its power or even its existence, race asserts itself in the endemic social problems in the non-white races among us, in the technological miracles of our own people, and in the canyons of cultural differences between us. Only when we understand and recognize the power of race can we solve the problems that it creates, as well as reap its magnificent possibilities. My understanding about race developed by extensive reading in psychology, biology, history, and anthropology had all come together, with each supplementing the other and reinforcing the racial idea. Not only was I convinced of the underlying reality of race, I found inspiration, for I now believe that racial understanding holds the key to progress in civilization and even the evolutionary advancement of mankind itself. I also understood that ignoring its reality could have disastrous consequences for a society. In the 1960s, America earnestly embarked on a program of social and political equality for the black race. What would be the outcome? Carlton Putnam and others applied the historical record and the evolutionary realities to America's new social policies. Because I knew that those social changes were based on the false dogma of racial equality, I came to believe that those policies were destined to fail. Egalitarianism was little more than a modern superstition imposed by the media political establishment. Its tenets were extremely vulnerable to rigorous challenge and debate. But I wondered, where is the debate? Advocates of egalitarianism held the seats of power in academia and in politics and in the popular media. Although many in the academic community knew its scientific absurdity, few dared to speak up forthrightly. Thankfully, many continued their research, but seduced by the rhythm of the times, they avoided its racial implications as much as they could. As more psychologists rediscovered the powerful role of heredity in intelligence and behavior, most talked about it in terms of how genetics affected the individual, while they very carefully avoided the racial issue, even though their work confirmed the facts of inherent racial differences. If one sees heredity as a primary determinant of mental ability and personality, then the dramatically lower black IQ scores and rampant black social dysfunction could only be plausibly explained by genetically determined racial differences. not by environmental determination. The acknowledgement of heredity's powerful role in group behavior and norms struck at the foundations of the myth of racial equality, and the racial egalitarians fought back with a viciousness bordering on religious hysteria. Some of the few academicians who dared to discuss race were, even in the most moderate fashion, such as Professor Arthur Jensen, were met with academic intolerance and physical intimidation. Scientific pioneers such as Nobel Prize winner William Shockley were physically restrained from scheduled speeches at some of America's most prestigious universities. Dr. Edward O. Wilson, premier sociobiologist at Harvard University, who tactfully avoided the race issue as much as he could, found himself victimized by both character assassination and violent assault. And as a side note for this audio tape, the great professor, Dr. Watson, who basically discovered the double helix of the DNA, an incredible discovery, probably the greatest scientist of our era, actually lost his job because he dared to talk about some racial truths which certainly can't be denied or refuted. In spite of desperate resistance, the essential tenets of sociobiologists, behavioral geneticists, and hereditarians eventually triumphed in the scientific community. Although few of them, even today, can afford to expound on the race issue unabashedly. A great gap continues to exist between the scientific view of race and the view posited by the popular media. The scientifically disproven views of Marxists such as Gould, Kamin, and Lowitin are still presented to the public as the mainstream scientific opinion in consumer-oriented magazines such as Discover and the Smithsonian. On a brighter note, however, behavioral geneticists have made great strides in educating the public in understanding the genetic basis of male and female behavior. Biologically born behavioral differences in male and female brains have found popular expression in new terms such as right-brained and left-brained. In the political realm, the acknowledgement of racial truth remains far scarcer than in science. Every politician quickly learns never to challenge the egalitarian view. To do so would invite political banishment. America's traditional, racially structured social systems were rapidly dismantled and then restructured on the false premise of racial equality. Carlton Putnam, Dr. William Shockley, Dr. Arthur Jensen, and many others showed how the new social experiments were failing and were destined to do severe damage to American society. But the media and government establishment relentlessly promoted and expanded the new racial policies. Areas having large black populations, such as those in the South and in the large cities of the North and West, quickly degenerated. Social disaster struck the black community first, as white controls and guidance were relaxed. Black crime rose to intolerable levels, schools deteriorated, illicit drug abuse and addiction spread out of control, illegitimacy soared, and the black family disintegrated. Welfare rolls exploded, venereal disease reached epidemic proportions. All these social calamities were the opposite of what the egalitarians had promised would occur with the granting of political and social equality. The veneer of European-style culture and morality imposed on the black community for centuries crumbled in the wake of social emancipation. Whites, of course, suffered from the changes as well. The quality of public education rapidly declined under integration. Millions of whites were driven from public schools and ultimately from the glittering cities they had built, fueling the rise of suburbia. Millions more fell victim to increased black crime. Whites endured dramatically higher taxes and paid the higher cost necessary to sustain an increasingly dependent and dysfunctional black community. And the political power structure changed as the minority voting blocs held the balance of power. The federal government also intensified its efforts to destroy underpinnings of the European American. forced busing, expanded racial integration, discrimination against better qualified European Americans, euphemistically labeled affirmative action, became institutionalized in the public and private sector. Government-funded minority housing programs systematically destroyed white communities all across America. Beginning in 1965, federal immigration policies began to discriminate against European immigrants while facilitating increased non-white immigration. At the same time, huge numbers of non-white illegal immigrants were allowed to overrun America's borders. Unchecked immigration, along with high minority birth rates, transformed much American geography into scenes and sociology reminiscent of the Third World. European Americans moved ever closer to minority status in our own country. As both black and white society suffered under these policies, no one questioned the shibboleth of racial equality. In spite of the sacrifice of their schools, neighborhoods, cities, tax money, and even many of their lives on the altar of racial equality, white people were not appreciated for their efforts, but blamed for the chronic black failure. European Americans were told that these worsening problems could be solved only by even higher expenditures for social welfare programs and education. And the egalitarians told us that the cure for what ailed America was really more integration, more multiculturalism, and, quote, diversity. To the media, government, establishment, whatever sacrifices whites made were never enough. By the end of the 20th century, most family core values had dissolved among blacks in direct correlation to their achieving greater social and political rights. As of this writing, more than 70% of black children are born illegitimate, and at any given moment, well over a third of all young black males in America are in jail, on probation, or parole. Perhaps the most devastating effect of the civil rights movement was the epidemic of crime that denied millions their most basic civil right of all, the right not to be physically violated by intimidation, rape, robbery, and murder. The next section is black crime. Quote, this is from black poet Leroy Jones, Mamou Amiri Baraka, similar to Barack Obama. Quote, you can't steal nothing from a white man. He's already stole it. He owes you everything you want, even his life. All the stores will open up to you if you say the magic words. The magic words are up against the wall, mother. You know what? This is a stick up. Or smash the window at night. These are the magic actions. Smash the windows daytime, anytime, together. Let's smash the window, drag the shit from in there. No money down, no time to pay. Just take what you want. Unquote. Perhaps the most pernicious effect of the new race-blind policies was a crime rate never before seen in Western civilization. Until the time I became racially aware in my mid-teens, I had never thought much about black crime. Living in an all-white neighborhood and attending all-white schools and churches, I had no fear of crime because I had no experience of it. If I returned home late at night on the dimly lit streets of my neighborhood, the only fear I had was that my father's punishment for being late. Crime concerns never crossed my mind. Since the enforced joys of integration and diversity, of course, every child now becomes conscious of crime almost before he learns his ABCs. Other than our housekeeper, Pinky, the most contact I had with blacks was working occasionally at Gary's Garage, located on Clio Street, a black section of New Orleans on the periphery of the business district. Now, that was before the civil rights movement's social changes had much impact on the mores or lifestyles of either blacks or whites. Of course, I knew that the black areas of New Orleans were more dangerous. Sometimes when I was finishing up on a job, I stayed until after dark. The first times in my life that I had real fear of crime occurred when I walked from the shop down the trash-laden block and a half of the garage to St. Charles Avenue and my streetcar stopped. During the short walks, I sometimes saw a menacing stare or heard an ill-bred comment or two coming from the dark faces in the shadows. The clanging of the streetcar bell often accompanied my own sigh of relief as the steel tracks below carried me away from the dark street. One of the reasons I stopped going down to the shop was that the Times-Picayune and the television news had increasingly frequent stories of crime very near the area I visited. After the well-publicized robbery and murder of a delivery man only one street down from the repair shop, my father wouldn't let me go there anymore, at least not by myself. On some Saturdays, I would ride down with him when he had some repair work to be done. Books, magazine articles, and television shows seldom discussed the black crime rate, instead just referred to the rising crime rate. When higher incidences of crime among blacks were reported by the media, they never explicitly revealed its incredibly disproportionate levels as compared to those of whites. Most white Americans even today aren't fully cognizant of them. The media offered poverty and racism as the simple explanations for black crime. In effect, they were saying that it was white people who were ultimately responsible for it, that the repression of blacks by the white social system caused the poverty that in turn caused the crime. At that time, I accepted the explanation because it sounded logical. And after all, I had seen no counter evidence in the mainstream media. 3 years after reading Race and Reason, by my 16th birthday, I'd learned a great deal about racial differences. I had filled a fair-sized mahogany bookcase in my room with the books and articles that I had read and researched. I could have probably filled another one with the material I had read or borrowed from the public school library and from the Citizens Council shelves. I knew of the racial difference in IQ and how IQ strongly is correlated with higher rates of criminality. The lower the IQ, the higher the crime. I also knew that differences in the brains of blacks and whites, and even the differences in hormones, such as higher levels of testosterone in black males, had an influence on crime. I was also aware of the studies showing different behavioral patterns of blacks and whites that could not be explained away by environment. And I had a grasp of the rudimentary evolutionary differences that had been simultaneously created over the tens of thousands of years in the ice ages of Europe and in the tropics of sub-Saharan Africa. Those evolutionary characteristics seem consistent with the historical record of civilization. I liked science and history much more than politics, and that's what I concentrated on, delving into my books and articles on race every day. Now that I live much further from the forests and swamps of New Orleans, I spent much more time engrossed in reading. I also developed a keener interest in the effects of racial dynamics on current events. Most of the books I found in the library sported the liberal interpretations, but the Citizens Council had one of the best libraries in the South on race and related conservative issues. A number of the authors argued that the dramatic increase of crime, coinciding with the change in the black and white social structure, warned of a dangerous future for the nation. America was declining much like the civilizations I had read about. The coming racial disaster seemed as clear to me as the increasing frequency of police sirens that interrupted the humid, once quiet summer nights of New Orleans. At the same time that blacks made great economic gains through the civil rights movement, black crime increased dramatically. By the mid-1960s, blacks making up 11% of the population were committing almost half of the most violent crimes. The media exclaimed that poverty and justified black resentment for white racism had caused the crime explosion. but none of the pundits and social interpreters could explain away the underlying inconsistencies. If poverty and its effects were the primary culprits of crime, why was it that whites, who were close to 90% of the population and at least two-thirds of the people under the poverty level of income, were committing only half the crime? I pointed out to one of my teachers that it wasn't only the poor who committed crimes. Sometimes middle-class people and even upper-income people violated the law. Shouldn't 9/10 of the population and 2/3 of the poor be committing the vast majority of the crime if it was social factors? I asked. The next line of argument, fashioned to explain all black difficulties and chastise racially impious thoughts, was the allegation of white racist injustice. But, I thought, haven't there been millions of whites who have been cheated or mistreated by other people and who have suffered broken families, alcoholism, child abuse, and other indignities, but who don't, as teenagers, run out into the night and rape elderly women? At the time, in my area, a number of elderly women living alone were brutally raped and abused by black intruders. This is something that still goes on today in modern America, in 21st century America. If oppression and racism causes crime, I question why the black crime rate was far less under Jim Crow than it is today. When I brought up these issues to my teachers, they had inadequate answers. Moreover, if one accepts that poverty causes crime, the question must be asked, what causes poverty? Good question. Murray and Herrnstein and the bell curve and many other researchers have shown that low IQ correlates strongly with poverty and criminality. Inability to delay gratification would also contribute to joblessness and poverty. Black lower IQ and less ability to delay gratification have already been thoroughly covered in this volume. Yet, even if one accepts the poverty and repression argument, it certainly could not explain the incredible extent of the differences.